There's a story that you shared with me years ago, and this is kind of when, you know, a lot of the cats in town started noticing, discovering, not finding out, you know, that you could play. And you know, there's a great lesson in this. And you were really, really grilled one day years ago on, in a good way, just to kind of see where you were, you know, like transposition-wise, range-wise, stamina-wise. You know, some of the cats had a little bit of fun with you, from what I remember. You want to kind of chat a little bit about that?
Yeah, if there's anything to Los Angeles trumpet hazing, this would have been that day for me. Yeah, you know, some of the elder statesmen, amazing players in town. Yeah. We got connected, let's say, and they said, well, why don't you come and play for us? Come on over. And it was actually one trumpet player in particular. So come on over, and then it ended up being a few people there, two trumpet players there, and they sort of, to use an old wrestling term, tag teamed and beat me up for the course of about an hour to an hour and a half. I'll never forget it. We played so much music, you know, they would have me play really hard, high stuff, and then really soft classical stuff, and then really, and there was always going to be a point, like, we have to be able to do this, you have to be able to do that, and look, it was not great. I was so nervous. I was shaking. I was sweating. I was, you know, it was so scary. But, you know, there's not a lot of work going around in town. And, you know, funny enough, for one of them, it was a, you know, stay out of my house kind of thing, you know. And then the other person who was there ended up becoming a really great friend and also put me under his wing. And I'll tell you, that was Gary Grant. Who's, I mean, talk about somebody who's been widely recorded. That guy's done thousands of records.
He's legit.
A part of the Hay Horn section with Jerry Hay and Michael Jackson, and, you know, so many things, so many motion pictures. And, you know, I think he worked a lot with Sylvester, who you mentioned earlier,
and
so many other people. But anyways, he called me up later and he was like, you did, you know, kind of the whole, you did good, kid, you know, thing. And we became great friends and still are to this day, even though Gary's retired now. I called my parents when I was driving home and I said, it's over. any chance I had, I just left. I just left the house of where my soul is now, and it is gone. It was a pretty crazy day.
Yeah, I was, we had Alan Sylvester in the program not so long ago, and one of the things we were talking about, just kind of the last thing you said, brought it to mind, this concept of fear. And we were talking about how the concept of fear, the idea of fear, if it's embraced well and it's used in a positive manner, it can actually really help to clarify certain things in our professional lives as musicians. And whether or not that's, you know, getting over your stage fright of performing on the stage, or it's, in your case, you know, getting hazed, or, you know, not being the guy to have to do take 3, 4, 5, and 6 and something on the recording stage, you know. There's a lot of physicality that goes into musicianship that a lot of people that not only are musicians, but certainly those that aren't, might either kind of forget about it, or they're unaware of, or, you know, whatever that might be. And the physicality manifests itself in more than just being able to play beyond 4 hours and breaking through your tiredness. A lot of that physicality is actually psychological. You know, that is a physical thing, the psychosis of playing. And how do you get over fear? You know, I mean, let's talk about that for a second. Can you recall one or two or three kind of seminal moments in your life, other than the one you just kind of described, where you had to deal with a certain level of fear and it became something that you, I imagine, ultimately learned how to embrace? Because it sounds like you've embraced it, if you even have it anymore.
Well, yeah, I mean, I still get nervous. I think everybody does to some point. I think what I've learned now is that, you know, the more prepared you are, the more able you are to handle those nerves. But I've always had a bit of stage fright. You know, when I was a kid, first few times I remember, you know, I finally got to be in my dad's high school marching band, you know, the big dream to play trumpet. And I was throwing up on the sidelines before halftime because I was so nervous. Who cares? I'm this freshman trumpet player. There's, you know, 25, he had a big band. There's 25, 30 other trumpet players there. And I'm, the director's son is barfing in the corner of the football field, you know. I was so nervous. I don't know why. It is what it was. And I'll never forget, I can remember the band parents being around me every time and everything. So I've always had this stage fright, I guess, really is what it is. And you learn how to deal with it. You learn how to, try to, breathing helps, trying to get into whatever your Zen place is. And then, again, mostly just being prepared, knowing that you can do whatever's about to happen. You can do it. It may not go exactly like you want it to, especially when you're playing live, you only got one shot. So let's see. So I remember being nervous for that. You know, I remember the first time I walked into a studio, I got really nervous and just, I think everybody, there's like maybe a little nervous energy. You're there for the first time. You want to play well and all that stuff. But what I won't forget is, I think my first kind of real big session was, one of the Family Guys and when they start the clicks and at Fox Studios at that time, when they started the clicks, the lights went off. And there was just all the lights go down.
Yeah, I remember that.
And just your music stand. And you feel like, as a player, that the whole room is looking at you. Even though you're not, I'm just playing third or fourth trumpet down there. It doesn't matter. I mean, it does matter. But, I have no pressure, really. But I was like, oh, my God, where'd the lights go? Why did they turn off? And getting used to that, sensation. And you have that sensation being in a pit orchestra, but the lights aren't going on and off all the time. They're just kind of staying off or whatever. So I remember that being, a nervous thing for me. And then you still get nervous when you're performing live or when you're performing for a big composer. The first opportunities you have to play first trumpet, you're being like, you're kind of in the hot seat now and you're leading the brass section and having to make all the decisions about articulations and stuff. There's so many things that can make you nervous, but I remember those being in particular. The first time you go live on TV, that can be nerve wracking. Mm-hmm. I did Dancing with the Stars for a number of seasons. I subbed in the band for a while. And then I actually took over for Warren Looney, believe it or not, in that band too.
Was Harold Wheeler?
It was Harold Wheeler. He was the music director. Yeah, and I remember going live with Dancing with the Stars. Something was different about when I was actually there and I was the person. Again, just playing third trumpet.
Yeah.
But I became, now this is my job. I got to be here for this and I got to do well because I don't want to lose this gig.
Yeah.
So the stuff like that, first time you do Academy Awards, it's live to whatever. They always say like a billion people around the world. That's nerve-wracking. Yeah. You don't want to be the one to mess up. Yeah. Everybody's going to be talking about it.
Yeah.
From here to across the world, so
yeah, the third, fourth trumpet reference you kind of made. Who knows if this story or these stories that I've heard kind of collectively over the years are true, but I imagine that perhaps somewhere in the middle, maybe some of them are, some of them aren't. But I had heard years ago, and I actually heard this from Jerry Goldsmith, that Andre Previn, he was a really interesting character. He was a prodigious talent. But the stories go that, he had an amazing working relationship with folks over here and a not so amazing working relationship with others over here, which is perhaps not uncommon, but the way it manifested itself, I've heard are some pretty interesting things. And one of those stories is that he would often keep the interior players on their toes, the third, fourth players, trombones, trumpets, even horns, where he would have the orchestra playing tooting, and all of a sudden he would drop everyone out and he'd put the solo in the third trumpet, or he'd put the solo in the fifth horn, without them knowing, without marking it solo. And then all of a sudden, wham, everyone's out and they're playing, and it's like, just like this bucket dropping thing. Again, who knows how much of that is true, but there's so many stories like that, right? Especially in Los Angeles, just the amount of dynamic and personalities that exist across the industry to kind of collectively come together and create these results. It's
yeah,
it's funny
stuff. Oh yeah, there's a lot of stories. I mean, there's, you know, who knows how much of it is true, how much of it is not, but it's funny. Every composer has, you know, has their thing, and you know, 99% of them are a pleasure to work for. Yeah. Unbelievable musicians, composers, you know, writers. They have to deal with so much behind the scenes, more than what we're having to deal with just out on stage. I mean, the lead up just to recording day is months, if not, you know, years on some bigger projects.
Right.
And it's really a pleasure to get to work for a lot of these, you know, composers. Yeah.
So let's talk about, briefly, Maurice Murphy. So, I didn't know this actually until just recently, that his first soiree with the London Symphony Orchestra, I mean, when he was formally finally the principal trumpet, was the first note to Star Wars. You know, we all know the legendary sounds and stories that come from, you know, episodes 4, 5, and 6 with Maurice. You know, he was one of those guys that had the ability to play just slightly brighter than everybody else in the orchestra without ever sounding sharp. Mm-hmm. And so he just had this icing on the cake that very few players in history have ever had. And the reason I bring his name up is because he always went for it, always went for it. And you've heard me say this a few times over the years and some of the things we've done, and I still say it to this day when I have the opportunity to, and that is, look, if you're going to miss, miss big. And
I can do that.
Yeah. You know, we all have from time to time. And I think once you kind of embrace that spirit, you know, look, some of the greatest recordings you and I have ever heard, you know, I can think back to one of my favorites ever, was Sir George Schulte recording Mahler's Fifth Symphony. And at the peak, well, I guess it was the penultimate peak of the second movement, massive, massive cack in the horn. But you know what? They left it in because, I imagine because the energy and the passion and everything else surrounding that one little tiny thing was just ridiculous. I mean, there was no, you know, hearing the final product, it's like, well, okay, that's why they left it in, obviously, because everything else is just like tear jerking. So let's talk about that a little bit. This idea, two ideas. One, going for it, is particularly as a principal trumpet player. You know, we learn early on that instrument has a tendency to come out a little bit.
Yeah.
We have to learn to control it, not unlike an alto saxophone. But the second issue being the psychology in the modern recording environment of always trying to seek this, in my opinion, this ridiculous level of almost stale perfection. You know, and sometimes you're recording 3 bars over and over because there's one little tiny thing that just doesn't sound perfect. And I know that that's subject to a wide range of variables and personalities and interpretations, and I get it. I'm not discounting any of that. But the idea of missing big and the idea of just this perfection in the modern recording environment.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, when I hear you talk about that, what I think of is just, you know, with the way everything has to be mocked up now, for those who don't know, like, you know, most composers now, before we get into actually record these things live, they have to, you know, have these amazing playbacks in their computers that they build with, you know, their DAW, their digital audio workstation. So they have these pristine epic recordings with samples. There's nothing is ever missed. It's perfectly balanced. You know, and things just, they sound a little different live, you know, sometimes first trumpet player might put a little extra sauce on something but I think, you know, if I'm reading your question right, I think it varies from composer to composer. It's funny, you know, you get the all perfectionists, right? John Williams or Alan Silvestri, James Newton Howard, or, I'm leaving out so many, I'm sure.
Yeah.
You know, any of these, you know, big name composers that we all know of, I mean, they strive for perfection. They want perfection, but you can always tell they're looking for the music too.
Yeah.
And I love that, you know, the greatest composers, they all let the music breathe how it's going to breathe that day, however it's going to be. sometimes, you know, we'll get a new composer who's up and coming and they're amazing and stuff, but they haven't had that experience of standing in front of an orchestra and letting an orchestra do its thing. Mm. And so that's when we get into that fine tuning, you know, real nitpicky. I need it to sound exactly like my samples sounded like in the computer, and this is too loud and that needs to be louder. And so that gets a little frustrating because, you know, obviously we want to have the best product, but sometimes what they're asking us to do is almost unplayable, especially when it comes to like really extreme ranges and dynamics and certain other things. So that can be a frustrating aspect, but again, there's very few composers that are like that.
Yeah.
Well,
let's kind of back up. I'm trying to think of outside the Henry Mancini Institute, the first time that I guess we kind of really had any professional experience together in the recording environment, was it the LA Brass Ensemble? Was it that, or was it something else?
Well, LA Brass, I think, happened after Mancini, right?
It was after Mancini. So I'm thinking like beyond Mancini, what was that first thing that we kind of did together?
Yeah, well, I think that was probably the biggest project that you were in charge of, where you were doing the LA Brass and we were kind of putting together a group of musicians, brass musicians, to record the music that you had done and arrangements you had done. And I think other than that,
I think that was one of the first things.
That was probably the first thing.
Yeah. The reason I bring that up is because, you know, I'm just kind of thinking as you're talking, I can't believe it's been that many years already since we did whatever that was. And, you know, as we both know, it didn't really kind of blossom into anything much, at least as the vehicle that it was intended to be then. But now looking back all these years later, to kind of see where not only you went, but some of the players in the group, where they've gone, and just kind of a little bit of, you know, a little bit, a tiny, tiny bit of self-reflection in that the more and more I think about where cats like you and, you know, Danielle Andarza or Steve Siminski or, you know, any of those cats that were in the group originally, it's reminded me just how little we've worked together in the last couple of years. And you know, just kind of speaking almost kind of peripherally here, now that we're in this bizarre COVID-19 environment globally, it's helped to, at least for me, and I know for you to some degree, we haven't talked about a whole lot, but we have a little bit. It's starting to clarify the things that we really want out of our career, out of our life, how we attain those goals in kind of other ways, you know, having to find other paths to those goals, because so many of the paths that we've all known in the last few years have just been eviscerated. And we don't know when they're going to come back, if ever. So it's an interesting thing, you know. It's so I've kind of gone into a combination of what have I done the last 7 years exactly, and oh my god, I just turned 40. What is going on here?
I'm talking like a bunch of old geezers here,
man. Jeez. You know, I was like, I don't feel. It sounds like I don't feel like it yet. But I mean, how have you kind of dealt with that concept? You know, these avenues that we've all been accustomed to having gone away due to this situation we're in, and what are some of the things that you're doing that might inspire other musicians out there to kind of think outside the box?
Yeah, let's see. Well, for me, I've always been a teacher. I like teaching.
Yeah.
I like trying to share the knowledge that, you know, so many people have given to me. So I teach at two colleges, Cal State University Long Beach and at La Sierra University, basically out in Riverside. And, you know, so that's been good. I'm still been teaching. In fact, I made a joke. I did a masterclass for some students in, I think, Arizona a couple days ago. And I joked with them. I said, if you're not practicing right now, you better be, because every single famous trumpet player that you are aspiring to be is nothing to do but time and to practice. That's all they're doing right now. You know, I mean, there's nothing else to do. So it's like you just kind of go to your studio, go to your little practice room, and you just try to get through as much music as possible. Unfortunately, it's not the same like playing in an orchestra or a big band or something. You're just playing by yourself. So you do the best to try to replicate that stuff. But you know, for this, I sort of had a small side career doing some orchestration and arranging projects. various, like some video game stuff with League of Legends, and then I help Hollywood Scoring. I help those guys do a bunch of arranging for the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade in July 4th celebration, which actually we finished just last month. So I've taken this time to not only obviously keep up my chops and practice and do all those things, and also spending a lot of quality time with my two little boys.
Yeah.
But I've kind of dove into really learning Pro Tools. I kind of know Pro Tools. I'm really trying to learn Pro Tools, which is a main recording program that we use, to record, orchestras, you know. And then digging into learning how to do those mock-ups that I was describing earlier. I actually just finished, I don't know when this will come out, but hopefully it'll be after. I just finished doing a big mock-up and a couple of little things for Disney and ABC for the next Disney sing-along. So I've been lucky to have that work come in. I'm really just trying to get better at, as I tell my students, keeping all these plates spinning. So I've got my, you know, classical trumpet and my kind of commercial trumpet, and then my sort of orchestration, and then my composing and arranging. I'm just trying to, you know, again, it all goes back to my trumpet teacher, John Almeida. I want to be able to say, yes, I can do that if the phone rings. Yeah. And that's, you know, and be comfortable saying yes. That's so important. That's an important part of it. Yes, I can do that. I was a little nervous when the music director for the Disney sing-along called, and she asked me if I could do this, and I was like, I don't know, we're gonna find out though in the next 48 hours if I can do this. So but everybody's thrilled and they're happy, and so I'm looking forward to that coming out. But yeah, I think just, you know, you have the time, learn how to really record yourself well. Not just learn how to record yourself, learn how to record yourself well. Get the EQs right, get the, you know, record yourself at home, because composers are going to ask you for that kind of stuff. Or you're going to want to record for your students. If you're around, you know, anywhere around the world, you're going to want to be a great teacher and teach your students how to record themselves. Learning these production programs, being able to pass that on to your students is going to be so important. So just try to dive into all the things you thought, I really wish I knew how to do that. I think this is the time, obviously, to do that.
I think you're right that if there's not 10 guys, there's probably 100 guys or gals that are, you know, doing what you're aspiring to do, and they're putting their foot to the floor and they're practicing.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny when you get into the thick of being a pro in whatever environment it is in the music world, you don't have the time and oftentimes forget. I mean, I was talking about this not too long ago on another podcast episode where I had all of a sudden remembered, like in a flash, literally sleeping under the pianos in practice rooms back at UCLA in the day. You know, I mean, when you had that ability to sleep and then wake up at, you know, 6 a.m. after 3 hours of sleep just so you could have the first crack at the practice room. You know, you don't have that luxury when you get older, when you're in the business, when you have a family, you know, all of a sudden all these other priorities that you, of course, don't have at all when you're a younger pre-professional, you know, person. Now all of a sudden we're kind of being thrust into that again in a little way. So, you know, it's bizarre. I think it's a bizarre feeling. I'm the only one that comes into the office, still into the studio. I'm struggling to figure out how all this stuff works. I don't have anyone telling me what to do. and like you, I'm trying to learn Cubase, and it's like, you know, what am I doing? Just let me hit the record button and I'll play. I know how to do that.
Right.
You know, and I'll go back and do another pass. But, you know, you're right. Getting the EQs right and everything else right, it's a whole other thing. But,
you know, if I could interrupt real quick, there's what's funny about, you know, we've been asked to do a few projects from home at this point in time. So, me personally, I did an episode of the Animaniacs. I did a Mickey Mouse cartoon thing for Chris Willis and kind of some various small little projects. And I think the one good thing for all the composers and orchestrators and engineers out there is that musicians have learned really quickly how difficult it is to actually record yourself and do it well. There's so much that I think the, you know, we always have had great respect for what everybody's doing in the booth, but now more so than ever, to sit here and have to, hit record and go play and then stop yourself and then edit it and then make sure it sounds good and then send it off and make sure the volumes are all correct and make sure it doesn't sound crappy, you know?
Yeah, I know.
So I think that's been a big thing that I know a few of the musicians I've talked to is like, wow, you know, this is difficult. And obviously we always knew it was difficult, but having to learn that and do that on your own has been really tough.
Well, you know, when we come out of this, it's going to be an interesting environment because I think, you know, a lot of us will have hopefully honed another chop or two, you know, in some way. And I think the spirit with which kind of coming back and having an environment where we're finally all together again, it's going to be just a giant, you know, I think we're all excited for that, for a lot of reasons, but, you know, certainly from a personal one, you know, it's just, I miss that kinetic connection, to, you know, human beings that are more than just your immediate family. Cause we need that. And our kids need that. My gosh. I mean, you have two boys, I have two girls, and that way they're super lucky to have each other through all this mess, but all good. What, if there's anything that kind of just pops into your head, is there anything you haven't accomplished yet in either your career or just your life in general that you want to go after in the immediate future? And what is it? One thing that comes to mind, not only one. One thing that comes to mind. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Cool, man. Yeah, man. Yeah. 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 Yeah, it's true. Well, you know, it's put yourself in a little bit outside of your comfort zone, try and find things you haven't done and just keep, you know, keeping the grill to the floor. And, you know, it's a long career if you can kind of approach it from that way. So, I'm sure at some point you'll capture, if not both of those, some of that. So, well, look, man, I super appreciate your time. It's great chatting with you. Hopefully we'll be able to hang and get a drink soon. I love you, man. So thanks for coming on the program. I really appreciate it. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely, man. Pleasure. Everybody out there, Film Music Focus, Rob Scher. This was a fun one. Hope you enjoyed it all as much as I did. We'll see you next time for Film Music Focus.
Brought to you by Santa Concerts.